This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Black mothers gather once again to tell the stories of their children struck down by killer cops. The Black is Back Coalition demands Black community control of the police at its national conference in Philadelphia. And why is Bernie Sanders so gung-ho about Saudi Arabia's war against Yemen?
But first, Black people all across the country are effectively being disenfranchised by state takeovers of their public schools. So says Karan Blair, executive director of the Alliance to Reclaim Our Schools, a coalition of 9 organizations representing more than 7 million students, educators, and community members. Blair says state takeovers have accelerated across the country, almost exclusively in heavily Black and brown districts.
The takeovers of these districts is rooted in an idea, in a belief that Black people, Black, brown, and middle-income poor folk are incapable of governing themselves. And so we have got to give their communities over to sort of the patronage of state-run, generally white administration. That's a big part of what we're witnessing, the ways in which Black and brown communities are being stripped essentially of democracy. That's the first thing. The most grievous piece is that, okay, say you take our democracy away, you take our right to govern ourselves away, but then you hand us essentially failing institutions. So that's a double whammy, that you take away our ability to govern. It's what we're seeing in Chicago, right, where parents are literally starving themselves for the right to implement a school and a plan that is the best thing I have seen in a long time. So we said, no, you don't get to do that because you're Black and brown and you really can't do what it is you're proposing to do. So let's give it to the state or to the city. And then we give it to them, and then they give us failing institutions that end up being about profit that then make money off of the backs of our children. I think that's what we're witnessing. And that's grievous on so many levels.
Yes, in terms of local government control of the schools is probably the top item on most citizens' list, but increasingly and especially, of course, in fact, almost solely in Black and brown cities, that control, that democracy at the base over local education is being taken away.
Absolutely. And it is being taken away, right, because democracy, people having a voice, having the right to vote and participate, is ultimately about accountability. How do we hold people accountable? And when you say to them, you don't get to choose who represents you, you don't have a voice at the table, it takes away accountability so that now these folks, they don't have to do anything the community wants. Again, let's go back to Chicago. If you had an elected school board, if you had local control, the folks on the board, when people announced they were going on a hunger strike, they would be concerned about the implications for the next time they have to come to the public and ask the public for their support to be on the school board. But because we have a board that is essentially insulated from that kind of accountability, they can watch parents and grandparents literally fall to the ground because they haven't eaten in 10 days and say, we're hearing, we're watching, this may not be resolved the way you want it to go. Similarly, in New Orleans, right, when people protested, when people demanded that these schools not be closed, when the unions fired back, because you have, again, an unelected board, you're sort of like, well, we don't have to listen to you. You can cry, you can demand, you can organize, you can strike, you can protest, but when you have people who are not elected or you don't have local control, right? If you go to New Orleans, you know, to get to Baton Rouge, is an hour. Ain't no public transit to Baton Rouge. So when you have state control, even your elected officials are inaccessible to you. And that means they are insulated from accountability, which means they can do whatever they want to do, knowing that the people who are most impacted really have no way of holding them accountable. And then we end up being screwed in massive and serious ways.
I live in New Jersey, and for decades, every major city in the state, and every major city in the state is heavily black and brown, the schools have been taken over by the state. And although they have local school boards, they have virtually nothing to say about what mm-hmm. goes on in the schools. And yet New Jersey is praised as having some of the best school systems in the country based upon its schools in its mostly white communities, none of which have been taken over by the state.
And that's the argument that we make in the report, right? So, you know, when it comes to race in this country, you can never look at general statistics, because the general statistics always tell a very different story. For all intents and purposes, life in America is great. The median income is XYZ, right? The average person gets AB. But when you racialize that and you say, well, let's look at black folk and brown folk and poor folk, you know, let's look at how well they and southern folk, let's look at how well they're faring. Those numbers are essentially decimated, right? So when you take a look at New Jersey, like you just said, yes, when you take median or averages, you go, oh, things aren't so bad. But a lot of those schools are not working for people who have historically found themselves in the socioeconomic margins of our country. And that's what we're lifting up. And yet, those are the schools being taken over, and those are the communities that are being stripped of the right to govern themselves and make good decisions rooted, as D2 Brown out of Chicago said, love and deep knowledge and deep commitment to these communities. That's a part of what's at stake, that the people who know best are being stripped of the ability to participate in the decision-making that impacts their own lives. There's something un-American and clearly anti-black about that.
It appears that school charterization and state takeovers, or at least strong mayor forms of government, go hand in hand.
It does. And a part of what we are examining, again, the question for us is why, like what's happening? And more, the broader reality is that in American life, in an American democracy, more and more aspects of our lives are being privatized. And for people who are all about profit, for people all about the market, that works for them. But again, for black, brown, and poor folk, the market has never been our friend. The market has not served us well, because what ends up happening is that when we charterize or marketize these elements of our lives, our bodies become the instruments of profit. And so we push kids out. We now severely fund a school-to-prison pipeline, because the question is, how do we make these things as profitable as possible? How do we make them work efficiently? And efficiency has always come, I think, at the expense of black and brown communities. And that's the argument the report seeks to make.
What role does high-stake testing play in state takeovers and in denial of democracy, in denial of local control of schools?
You know, Madeline Talbot, who is our campaign director, said it best, that the testing is almost the fuel of the machine. It is the tool that legitimizes the takeover, right? So we say, well, let's create a bunch of tests to measure things that are ultimately irrelevant to whether or not a school is good or a child is well-educated. And then let's declare those schools as failing. And if they are failing, then let's make a bid for why they need to be taken over by the state. And then the state will give them to these contractors. Like, that's the model. And you watch it happen in New Orleans. You watch it happen in Chicago. You watch it happen in Philadelphia, you watch it happen in New York and Camden. And when you examine it, that is exactly what happens. We create these tests that in a lot of ways are not even, you know, I grew up in Jamaica, and the first time I went to school in Roosevelt in New York, and I remember these tests, and I was like, But this is not what we're learning in the actual classroom, right? So you create a test mechanism that is almost counter to what you learn in your everyday class, and then your intelligence is measured along those tests, and predictions are made about your future, which is then connected to the prison pipeline. Oh, you won't do well. You know, you shouldn't take a particular track. And so the tests become the engine or the fuel of sort of the takeover machine.
Secretary of Education Arne Duncan said famously or infamously that Katrina was the best thing that ever happened to New Orleans schools. And of course, Katrina resulted in an immediate state takeover of most of the schools, the firing of teachers, and as you would put it, total disenfranchisement of the population regarding education.
The first time I was in New Orleans, we sent students, about 500 students down to New Orleans and 2006, you know, these students slept on cots, they worked, and then I moved to New Orleans in 2007. I was there as an organizer and lived there for a while. And so I don't even know how to respond to that comment, right? It reeks of so much. It reeks of deep hatred, deep racism, a lack of understanding, a lack of humanity. Like, for anyone to say that Katrina was the best thing that happened to anything, it is such a deep disconnection. And it lays bare what the real problem is with the folks who get to run our schools, that they don't love our folk. They don't love our people, because anyone who loves Black people, Black community, Black culture would not dare say that. So that's the first thing. That's what I have to say about that. That, to me, it is not even worth validating. But to the extent that we address it, you know, Duncan is wrong, that the best thing to happen to any school district is schools that have rigorous curriculum, schools that are democratically ran, schools that are well-funded, right? The worst thing to happen to New Orleans schools is the 20 years that preceded Katrina of disinvestment in education, right? The 20 years that preceded laws that stripped schools of funding that then declared them or made them unworkable. And then we say, well, they're unworkable, so let's take them over. Right? That is the worst thing to happen to schools in New Orleans and across this country.
Black community control of schools used to be a rallying cry. What's happened?
I'm not sure. I do know, though, that, like, when we look at, again, what's happening in Chicago, in New Orleans, in Philly, the truth is, my dear brother, folks are resisting, right, in serious ways. What has happened is that we are living, I think, less and less in a democracy. And so the tools that made democracy work are now being invalidated. Right? Because parents in Chicago right now, 10 days, they've worked for 7 years on a proposal. The board pushed them around, ignored them, did an RFP process, promised a decision, is now not going to honor that. I was in New Orleans when people resisted and organized to stop the takeover of schools. I was in Philadelphia when students showed up at the board meeting and talked about why schools should not be closed. I was in Chicago when people organized to stop the closing of 40 schools, right? So Black folk are resisting. What we have, though, is a machine, a anti-democratic machine that does not have to be responsive to the cries and the demands of citizens. And that is the real problem. So that's what's happened. It's not that Black folk and folks who are being impacted are not resisting. We are resisting. But the system has become more and more undemocratic, so it is more and more unyielding to the demands of democratic citizens.
You speak of an anti-democratic machine, and you're speaking, of course, in a more general and institutional sense, but the Democratic Party has been even more aggressive than Republicans in state takeovers and charterization.
You know, this is a fascinating thing, because when we talk about schools and school takeovers and charterization, one of the things I've found doing this work is that a lot of well-meaning people are really on the wrong side of this. And so it is something that has, you know, the mayor of Chicago is a Democrat, right? Philadelphia, Democrats, New Orleans, right? So it is something for which both or all parties, not all, but both of the main parties in this country have really stand to be indicted for. I was at the press conference yesterday. One of the legislators in Illinois, Mary Flowers, she stood up and she said, I voted for the mayoral control of these schools. And she said, I was wrong. And she said, today I'm taking it back. And so Democrats in Illinois have introduced legislation to revoke mayoral control and to have an elected school board. And so there was a time, I think, when people meant well. And I don't want to say, you know, all of this was nefarious and people were trying to do evil to our children. There are well-meaning people who have taken votes that ultimately have been damaged in our communities. And what we need is more folks like Mary Flowers who will say, you know what, I did this and I thought it was the right way to go, but this has failed us and we need to take us some 10 steps back and reinstitute local control of schools so that parents and community members can be deeply engaged in building and running schools that our children deserve.
Your coalition has come up with a number of recommendations, and they begin with curriculum.
Yeah. Our website, reclaimourschools.org, our folks have been doing a lot of work on what does it take to have a good school. And it's so funny, right? No matter who you are, you are connected to schools, you're connected to education in some way. And if you ask the average person, what do you think school should look like? When you look at the work we've done, a lot of what we've talked about comes up. And so curriculum is key. That how do we educate our people, young people, to not only get jobs, but to be citizens, of this country, of this world, to be globally minded, to understand history, to be critical thinkers, to be problem solvers. And it is good curriculum, rigorous curriculum, challenging curriculum that produces those kinds of people. That education and public education, good curriculum, is a fundamental component of a strong democracy. That we need people who can think, who can challenge, who can ask critical questions. And we need curriculum that reflects that interest.
And one of your recommendations calls for something that you describe as transformational parent and community engagement in decision making and in planning. How does that work?
What we're talking about is democratically ran schools where parents do not have to go on hunger strike. And when you think that parents have to like not eat for 10 days to get the city to say, yo, this is good stuff, that's crazy. And so for us, that's transformative parent and community engagement means that there are ways in which parents can participate in the decision making that impacts their children. The other way that we think of transformative is not that the only people responsible for a school are teachers and employee staff, but how do we create ways, avenues, mechanisms for parents to be engaged in the day-to-day running of a school, right? What role can parents play in educating not only their individual children, but the broader community? And that kind of thinking is necessary. I was in a meeting in LA and I was talking to the Service Employees Union and they were like, you know, we have folks who are the support staff, the janitors, but these are also parents. And so instead of relegating a brother to, well, you clean the floors, what role can that brother play in a part of the education environment? So what we're calling for is a new way of thinking about how all of the adults connected to schools can play important and critical roles, right, that call upon their gifts and their talents, right, to help us educate our children.
We're witnessing an incipient movement in which there are calls across the country for the community to control the police. You are advocating that the community control its schools. Is there a point of intersection between these movements?
I think so. I think what people are saying is people who live in a particular place, neighbors, people who love each other, who have history together, ought to be responsible for decisions that impact their communities. And that when we have forces that don't know us, don't really care about us, those forces tend to act violently towards us. And violence looks like taking away our schools and giving them to operators that could care less what happens to us. Violence looks like a police force that in the last year has shot down countless, at this point, unarmed folks. And what we're saying is that community folks know best how to educate their children and how to police their communities.
That was Teron Blair of the Alliance to Reclaim Our Schools in Washington.
The Stop Mass Incarceration Network, co-founded by Dr. Cornel West and Carl Dix, is gearing up for 3 days of protests in New York City, October 22nd through the 24th. The Rise Up October campaign held a rally at the First Corinthian Baptist Church in Harlem last Thursday under the heading, What We Must Do to Stop Police Terror and Murder. The most effective testimony of the evening came from relatives of people killed by cops, like Juanita Young, the mother of Malcolm Ferguson.
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
What do we want?
Justice!
When do we want it?
Justice!
What do we want?
Justice!
Thank you. But that's not loud enough because I'm still trying to get Rivera for the murder of my son. On March 1st of 2000, my son Malcolm Ferguson was murdered in the Bronx by police officer Louis Rivera. He literally blew my son's brains out. After the DA, Robert Johnson, refused to indict this cop, I took the case to civil court. In civil court, my attorney, Seth Harris, was able to get Louis Rivera to admit what really happened. According to Rivera, he murdered Malcolm for no reason. When you ask, why did you shoot him, he don't know. But why is this man still out on the street today? That's why I have to keep asking for justice. Because there is no way this man is still able to walk and be a police officer. And I have to live and cry every day because I can't touch, see, or hear my son. My family is destroyed by the loss of their brother. After 15 years of helping so many other families to deal with the pain of losing a loved one, watching this system allow these low-lifed police officers, because you can't tell me there's no good cop, bad cop, because when you stand by and allow that other cop to do harm to another person, you're just as guilty as that cop that put that bullet in his head. I don't go for a good cop, bad cop. I stand up here today and tell you, I'm going to stand for these 275 faces that's been murdered here in New York alone. That's why we need to rise up for October. We need to let the people know we had enough. We had enough of y'all coming in to our community, destroying families. We had enough of nobody paying attention. These politicians, these presidents don't give a damn, excuse my language, about us. Because why? That's why these 275 cases, not one of them got any justice. Why? Because of the people that's protecting them. All of us sitting here today need to grab another 500 people and let's flood New York on October 22nd, 23rd, and 24th. Thank you.
Hello. I'm from Detroit, Michigan. My name is Myrtilla Jones.
Let's talk about this.
Juanita, it's my sister. She holding my back. I got a lot of people holding my back tonight. But my 7-year-old granddaughter, Ayanna Stanley Jones, was murdered May 16, 2010, by Detroit Police SWAT team member Joseph Weekly. I know I don't have enough time to go into everything that happened.
Let me tell you the problem here. I went to Detroit when Ayanna Jones was murdered. This is the grandmother that was laying on the couch with Ayanna. They were asleep when the cops came. They're supposed to be looking for some young man. They threw a grenade through the window. In the midst of throwing the grenade through the window, they shot, the police officer shot his gun. Now you imagine you sleeping on the couch with your grandbaby and you so helpless. The cop literally shot little 7-year-old Ayanna Jones, then turned around and arrested this woman, and they had her in jail for 8 hours, questioning her, talking, trying to say that she made the cop shoot Ayanna. They just took this case to trial. The judge went after the grandmother, told the grandmother she better not get up on that stand and show no emotion. She better not show no nothing, no feelings, no nothing. How dare he? This woman cannot close her eyes without seeing and what that officer did to Ayanna. You see the state she's in? This is the first time I've been up on stage with this grandmother, but I've been talking to her and following with her. And this is why we need people to try to say, which side are you on? How much more do we have to take?
The Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations held its national conference in Philadelphia. The theme was Black Power Matters, and the demand put forward was Black community control of the police. The conference occurred not long after members of the hashtag Black Lives Matter organization failed to make any demands during their encounter with Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. Black Agenda Report's Glenn Ford told the Black is Back conference that the leaders of the Black Lives Matter organization are trying to drag the Black People's Movement into the clutches of the Democratic Party, where progressive movements go to die.
For many months now, our incipient movement has been widely referred to as the Black Lives Matter movement. And that's because a small group of people came up with a very attractive hashtag, and that hashtag caught on. It caught on with the mass media, and it caught on with a lot of groups who felt comfortable being under an umbrella of that very attractive hashtag. And we at Black Agenda Report spent months referring to the Black Lives Matter movement. And that looked like a harmless thing to do for a while. And that's because it seemed, at least to us at Black Agenda Report, too confining to keep calling what was happening the Ferguson movement. We were thinking in terms of this being a national phenomenon, why keep calling it Ferguson? And so they had this very attractive, embracive, inclusive hashtag slogan, and why not? But the lumping of virtually all of the resistance activity under the handle of Black Lives Matter has gained that organization, and it is a small organization, great prestige, as if it was actually the headquarters of the whole political struggle. Yeah. Now they have done great damage to our emerging movement. And anybody who saw that video knows what I'm talking about. Great damage to our movement. You can't contain this kind of damage. It's out there. Up until now, we've had to contend, as I spoke of before, we've had to contend with Black organizations that were parroting the U.S. government's phony reforms and calling those phony proposals from the U.S. government people's demands. But the hashtag Black Lives Matter group has gone a step further. They have made a decision, a conscious decision, which they clearly discussed over a period of time and imposed some kind of discipline about. They've made a decision not to make any demands at all. This is no less than an attempt to liquidate the movement, to remove all political content from the movement's activities, and to turn the whole process into a showcase for the careers of the hashtag Black Lives Matter group's leadership. This group wants FaceTime, they want access to the ruling class and to the servants of the ruling class, and that's the candidates, their servants. This group is advertising, they are marketing their eagerness to collaborate with the powers that be by demonstrating that they don't have any intention of upsetting the status quo. That's why they don't threaten the system with demands. Demands are threatening if they are actually people's demands and not stuff that you get from the U.S. Justice Department. These folks are putting on a masquerade of militancy by disrupting a few candidates' events, but they refuse to challenge the system by making demands. And that includes even the mild reformist demands that they have posted on their own website. They didn't even bring that to Hillary. Since these hashtag folks reject making demands of the system, I think they should be considered to be outside of the movement. How can you be in the movement and have no demands of those in power? I don't understand that kind of politics. Maybe somebody else does. They are more accurately described as people who are maneuvering for instant entrance into the corridors of wealth and power by selling out the movement. When you sell out the demands, you sell out the movement. There can be no bigger sellout of the movement than dropping all of its demands, even the reformist demands. They are also doing everything possible to fold up the movement into the Democratic Party, the place where progressive movements go to die. It's one thing for the hashtag folks to audition for their own jobs and their own contracts. But their attempt to lead the movement wholesale into the Democratic Party is a greater crime, or maybe it's part of the same crime. Just as the police job is to contain and control black people's bodies and black people's movements, the Democratic Party's job is to contain and control black politics. The Democrats are just as responsible for the establishment of the mass black incarceration regime as the Republicans are. And black Democrats are more responsible for the fact that one out of every eight prison inmates in the world is an African living in the United States. They are more responsible even than the white Democrats. And that's because these black Democrats are in power in the cities where black people live, which is the places from which they are sent to prison, and they're the places where they are killed by the police. The hashtag Black Lives Matter group is using the prestige of the movement to kill the movement by delivering it to the Democratic Party, where movements go to die. The last thing we need to do is to deliver more black people to the Democrats. They already dominate black civil society. They already dominate all of the established organizations. They already dominate all of the politically active churches. They dominate the sororities and fraternities. That's our civil society. They have totally permeated all of our discourse. We don't have to deliver any more to them. Whatever Black Is Back does in terms of electoral politics in the future, it must have the goal of severing our people's ties with the Democrats. And I didn't mention the Republicans because the Republicans do not matter in our community. We should support no politician, black or white, who does not endorse the principle of allowing some degree of political autonomy for black people in the United States. Because without some degree of political autonomy, there can be no black community control of the police. Power to the people.
That was Glenn Ford at the Black Is Back National Conference. Last week, the Democratic National Committee endorsed the Black Lives Matter organization, with the Democrats heaping praise on the group's three co-founders. back in Philadelphia, Theodosia Benton of the Uhuru movement in St. Louis, Missouri, spoke to the Black is Back Coalition conference.
We ain't struggling for power. We ain't struggling for nothing. We ain't struggling for nothing. I don't care how many people been standing out there getting tear gas. I don't care how many people been shot with rubber bullets, which my legs are still wounded. I don't know if you can see it from where you're standing at, but I got bruises all down my legs from being shot with rubber bullets. But listen, people think it's a game. This is not a game. And we have to call it by its name. We have to say colonialism. It's important for us to call it by its name. Because white people know when we call it by its name, they know exactly what we're saying. We're talking to you. So it's important that we say the right names and call it. Don't get cute. And I don't care if you're uncomfortable in your seat, because you need to be uncomfortable. Because I've been uncomfortable for 35 years. Okay? So it's time for you to be uncomfortable. August 9th, on the anniversary of Mike Brown, they pushed the whole agenda on the people. I'm going to say this. I don't care who don't agree with me, but this is the truth. The truth should set all of us free. That's what the church people say, and I'm going to say it. That's the truth. The International People Democratic Uhuru Movement, January the 3rd, I believe, we had the Black grand jury. We know for a fact that it was people that told people not to come to this event. I met with people and talked to them, and they said, you guys sound like those people that's trying to start a race riot. I said, well, you must didn't hear me, because it don't have nothing to do with race. As the chairman always say, how do we fight against racism? How would I ever know that it's destroyed? Somebody gonna wave a flag and say, it's over? I mean, crack the heads open and figure out, you know, oh, they're not racist no more? That don't make any sense. So we have to fight against and struggle for power. So at this Black grand jury, it was very, if you haven't seen it, it's history. I'm trying to give you something to feed yourself, because this is power, okay? The first time in my life that I ever experienced anything like that. Actually, me and my comrades were trying to get out of doing it, because it was a lot of work, you know? So we was like, I don't know if we can do this. Can, you know, this is too much. But we did it, and it was very good. In the Black grand jury, we brought Kerry Ball Jr., Kerry Ball Jr. was killed by the St. Louis City Police in 2013. It was some motion around it, but it didn't get no trackway like the Mike Brown case. But his family fought a good fight for Kerry Ball, but it didn't get national attention. And so once I heard Mrs. Toni Taylor, his mother, a firecracker, that is support of the Black Coalition, that be out on the front lines as well, we brought her in. I heard her. I couldn't imagine. This mother, she know every single thing about her son, Case. She know every dot, every police officer, every date, everything. She knows it. And she been fighting a good fight. And then Von Derrick Myers was killed right after Mike Brown. We brought her in, too. And people was trying to just talk about Ferguson. They didn't want to say that this is a worldwide problem, that police everywhere is killing us. You know, they didn't want to say that. So the Black grand jury was very strategic, and we talked about the case of Mike Brown and what went wrong, and we said the whole state that this is something that is going on, and it was very beautiful, right? So back to August 9th, a year after, they seen the significance too. That's why it's important for us to lead. Lead, even when nobody show up, because they watching. So they took notes, the opportunists, because now they're reaching after these families and organizing and moving when they would move now. The families are getting more people to join and want to, you know, stand in solidarity with them. So it's important to lead, even if you don't have a whole bunch of people, and that's what I understand. So August 9th, they pushed this agenda and had this whole extravagant, you know, you had to have a lot of money to participate in this weekend. I mean, a lot of money got made on August 9th in Ferguson. Every day they had something, a dinner, hip-hop concerts, and all those different things. And in the midst of this, another African was murdered. And I'm going to tell you, I wanted this young man to be here, and my heart is broke right now because he didn't make it, and I don't even know where he's at. But he reached out to me because he said he was there when that African was killed. And he said, and they was not shooting at each other. I don't care what the cameras say. He said, the police was amongst us. He know exactly what happened when that African was killed and he was slaughtered. And they were having a shootout with the police, not with each other. And so we went out and we were met by tanks already. I'm like, how did they have these tanks here already? I mean, it just turned back into August 9th, created again, you know. And even after that, another African is killed. Nobody can find anything on the news about this African that's killed. The community spread the word on Facebook about this African is killed, and we gathered and we came down there. And I'm going to tell you right now, I just want to just give a round of applause to the young people in St. Louis City that came out fearless, y'all. They came out fearless. The police could not push them back. The police could not push them back. And even them paid protesters couldn't push them back. You know what I'm saying? The paid protesters had to move out their way because them young people was like, we're going to get them. We're going to get them. We don't care. You know what I'm saying? They said, they killing us anyway. You know, so the young people stood up that day and they still out there today and they out there every single night. They out there every single night, and that's what's going on in St. Louis, and it's going down every single night, but I think it's so important for us to not try to make friends, but to stand for the truth. You know what I'm saying? I'm not standing with nobody that don't understand that black people has to have power. And I remember when they said black community control of the police, I really thought that they came up with this after Mike Brown died. So I started doing my homework. I said, oh, they've been saying black community control of the police. They've been knowing that this was a problem. This is not some new thing. But our people are paying attention. And so we have to go out and organize. You know, I had a conversation with a sister here today, and she said to me, you know, it's a lot going on in our community, and I agree, you know what I'm saying, because right now, we have a tug of war where people say, well, what, y'all don't come out in March when it's a black-on-black crime. Well, see, I'm standing here that I lost my brother because an African shot and killed him, but I know that was still the state. So if I want to fix my community, I have to struggle for power. Anything. When we talk about the health care, my mom was in the hospital and they told her that she had to get something in her neck and do all this different stuff. And when I started standing toe-to-toe with these doctors, telling them, explaining what they doing, so basically we came down to it, y'all just want to try to bill her insurance. This don't, something she don't need, and she has the power to say that she don't need this because her body don't need that. So it's about educating ourselves. And when you come to things like this and you educate, because I came in just about police brutality, but now I don't eat pork no more. I'm on a diet. I work out every day. So if you want to help your community, go out and tell people that they got to struggle for power, and then they'll understand that power is every way that you've been touched by this system that is touching us. My time is up, and I just want to say uhuru.
That was Hurdosha Benton at the Black is Back Coalition's National Conference in Philadelphia.
Philadelphia is notorious for the brutality of its police. But the family of 22-year-old Tyree Carroll is fighting back against a police culture of violence. The young man was beaten by dozens of cops on the street in front of his home. A neighbor recorded the beating on videotape, and activists have been mobilized. Asantewa Nkuma Touré is a spokesperson for Justice for Tyree Carroll.
This happened in April of this year. He was in jail from April until August the 13th. He was finally released on bail. And it's just another case of police brutality in the city of brotherly love gone amok. Fortunately or unfortunately, in the case of Mr. Tyree Carroll, it was caught on video from his neighbors.
Yes, we see that he was set upon by a total of 26 officers. Two of them were black.
Yes, that's correct. The video show pretty much the entire incident where he was pounced upon by police. He was riding a bicycle going the wrong way on a one-way street. He lives in the house across the street from where he was attacked with his grandmother. And the police felt that they had the right the impunity to attack him because he has a previous record. Nothing in his past, however, justifies the brutal beating that he suffered. It was approximately about 10 or 11 police officers caught on video who were beating him, and a total of about 25 were on the scene watching and laughing as this was happening.
Philadelphia's police chief is a black man, and in fact, he chaired President Obama's task force on policing in the 21st century. What's his stance been on what his officers have done?
I don't recall any specific comments from Police Commissioner Ramsey there in Philadelphia, but I can tell you that, as you probably already know, he was a former police chief here in Washington, D.C., and due to several illegal, unlawful arrests and detentions of people who were protesting and not protesting, it cost the city thousands of dollars. D.C. taxpayers had to pay out thousands of dollars to lawsuits, and that was very embarrassing for the city. It was very embarrassing for then D.C. Police Chief Chuck Ramsey, and so therefore, sometime after that, he left the city and went to Philadelphia. And in the course of my working on the campaign in Philadelphia, I spoke at several community groups, and I made a joke about how the people of Washington, D.C. are so very happy to be rid of Chuck Ramsey. We were glad that Philadelphia took him off our hands, and it's the gift that keeps on giving.
The U.S. Justice Department has noted that in Philadelphia, you are 5 times as likely to be shot by a cop than a New Yorker is likely to be shot by a cop.
Yes, and that's true. Even while Chief Ramsey has been their police commissioner for the past several years, there were several other cases of police brutality that the community voiced a lot of concern about. One young man, I think his name was Brandon Tate, and several other young black men who had been beaten and or shot or even killed by Philadelphia police officers. So as we see, police brutality, police terrorism is a problem across the United States. And even a high-profile police commissioner such as Chuck Ramsey, it clearly has not made a difference. These things still keep happening.
That was Asantewa Nkrumah Touré on behalf of Justice for Tyree Carroll.
Baltimore community organizer Trey Murphy helped raise $500,000 bail for Alan Bullock, the 18-year-old who smashed the window of a police car during the rebellion over the cop killing of Freddie Gray. Alan Bullock's bail was higher than that set for any of the 6 cops charged in Freddie Gray's death. Community organizer Trey Murphy says high bail is just another weapon of oppression against black and poor people.
It's important to note that Mr. Alan Bullock is not the only high, ridiculously high bail that has been set like that. We had another $500,000 bail and then a $400,000 bail. There was a $250,000 bail and a $100,000 bail. So there's all of these bails that don't match the crime compared to the bails that were set for the 6 officers involved in the tragic death of Freddie Gray. You know, where the highest bail for one of the 6 officers was $350,000. The value of black and brown people like Mr. Alan Bullock lives don't matter, but the value of 6 police officers who have just gotten away with murder matter a tremendous amount more than any everyday citizen's life could ever matter. It is a scare tactic that has been used to suppress people's voices from elevating their voices around systematic issues that have taken place inside their communities for so long. No matter how poorly of a choice of a way they displayed anger, the community was justifiable in the anger that they displayed, right? And so the question is always, you know, how do we ensure that we're protecting those who are elevating their voices to speak out against systematic injustices?
That was activist Trey Murphy in Baltimore.
Presidential candidate Bernie Sanders is on the left wing of the Democratic Party, which is usually associated with anti-war positions. But the New Hampshire senator, who claims he's a socialist, seems to be encouraging the Saudi Arabian regime in its war against Yemen. According to Sam Husseini of the Institute for Public Accuracy in Washington, Bernie Sanders appears to get excited
about the Saudis waging war against their neighbors.
The reason that I chose really looking at this subject was that it seemed to be the subject that he was most passionate about. And it is incredibly dangerous and incredibly regressive. He's basically saying, he says that we got to fight ISIS, so the Saudis got to get their hands dirty. They have this massive military, and they have all this money, and they need to get in there and sort out the soul of Islam, as he puts it. And what could be more disturbing than that? He's basically calling for more and bigger proxy wars. He's justifying the tens of billions of dollars that the U.S. has profiteered by selling the Saudi regime. You'd think that he would say no, that the U.S. shouldn't be selling an autocratic, aggressive state like Saudi Arabia all of these weapons. That's actually, I compared Jeremy Corbyn in the U.K., in the midst of this campaign, is doing that. He's raising a ruckus in the U.K. He's running now, of course, for leadership of the Labour Party there. And he has some semblance of international solidarity, some meaningful adherence to human rights, and so on. And he's saying, what the heck? Why are we apparently violating British law by sending a massive human rights abuser all of these weapons? So why is Sanders doing this? Why is he out there? And he's not just out there, but he is, you know, it's when he catches fire. I've found two instances of him getting on Wolf Blitzer's show. Wolf Blitzer is a very pro-Israeli journalist, has a long history of that. And it's, I think, music to somebody like Blitzer's ear, because there's a tacit Israeli-Saudi alliance in the Middle East now, where they're sort of divvying up the pie under a U.S. establishment umbrella. And here we have Sanders leading the progressives to this awful position. You know, if people are going to give Sanders credit for putting income inequality on the agenda of the campaign, and maybe there's a case to be made for that, then I think that we should also say, hold on, his campaign is actually doing something regressive here. It's making the so-called progressive position further buttressing, further accelerating U.S. backing of the Saudi regime. I mean, let's not forget, Saudi Arabia right now is bombing Yemen. The U.N. is calling it an incredible human catastrophe. And we're supposed to want more of this? You know, we think that we can't bomb the Middle East to peace, but the Saudis can, because what, they're going to be better at it? They're going to have more democratic principles and more principles and a greater desire for a peaceful outcome of the Middle East. If they're in charge of who's getting bombed and in charge of the ground troops in wherever he's thinking of, Syria or Iraq or who knows where else.
Yes, in addition to their assaults on Yemen, the Saudis are among the main backers of al-Nusra and other jihadist groups in Syria. If Bernie Sanders, the senator, wants to foster further and more aggressive Saudi behavior, I would assume then that he would like the Saudis to stir up more jihadist activity in the region.
Absolutely. I mean, in Syria, it's been a major issue in terms of either from the government or from elements within Saudi Arabia have been buttressing jihadi elements, whether al-Nusra or even ISIS itself. But there's a long history of this. The Saudi backing of the Wahhabi sect has done incredible damage. It has deformed Islam, arguably, for decades, giving rise, in the first place, to al-Qaeda and so on. Shouldn't that be the progressive position? I mean, even maintaining a nationalist, allegedly progressive leader, why couldn't he say, somebody like Sanders, say, the Saudis are an autocratic regime, human rights abusers, they're backing these jihadis, they have a system of male guardianship, why the hell are they an ally? I mean, what domestic constituency exactly would he be offending by saying that? So it's quite a glaring stance that he's, I mean, what I'm articulating here is like a Michael Moore position. But we're not getting that. We're not getting close to that from him. We're getting a, let's encourage, let's greenlight the Saudis to be doing more bombing and more invading. So it is a really remarkable stance. So in a way, you know, people are asking for more foreign policy input from Sanders. I'm almost reluctant. I want less, potentially, if this is the kind of thing that we're going to get. And I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the tenor of his whole campaign, in a sense, has been very nationalistic and kind of turning its back on any precepts of socialist international solidarity. Even in positions where he's kind of good, I think you see that, like on trade. I mean, he'll talk about U.S. jobs. He won't talk about what it's doing to poor workers in Mexico or Asia or wherever. So in a sense, he's articulating a highly problematic nationalistic position, but he abandons that sense of nationalism in the most damaging case, I think.
Yes, it's one thing not to mention the word socialism, but to take positions that no socialist in his right mind would take, well, that's another thing.
To try to be generous here, I wonder if part of his calculation is that he's sort of signaling to part of the establishment that has so much power within the Democratic Party and the media and so on, that he's going to play ball on the foreign policy, which is what the large sector of the establishment cares about, is part of his calculation that he's going to get an airing for his income inequality stuff by going along with the foreign policy stuff. That's the most generous possible interpretation of this, which I think is kind of insidious because he's doing disinformation. He's malforming by being the most notable progressive on the U.S. stage right now, whether we like it or not. I guess we have to say that he is at this point. He's doing enormous damage by injecting this line of thought, which is so preposterous. And I haven't seen anybody challenge him on this. And I think at minimum, movements need to be challenging him directly.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.